Welcome to Back to the Future, the Zoomcast and podcast that puts those once and future predictions we've collectively made under the hindsight spotlight. My name is Martin Raymond, and this week, yes, you've guessed it, we're looking at COVID-19 and how many forecasters actually failed to call it. To help me unpack this, I'm joined by Devon Powers, who is the Associate Professor of Advertising at Temple University, Philadelphia. Devon, welcome.
Well, I predicted that you would say that, so I'm one for one for my forecast today. So yay to me. But hello, Martin. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, it's a real pleasure. I just, you know, Deb, just a few things about you. The author of On Trends, The Business of Forecasting the Future. But, and I guess this is the reason we're having a chat today, you also wrote a fantastic column on Medium about forecasters and their professional blind spot, I'm reading it out here, to anticipating the true impact of COVID-19. Now, just to be clear about this, you said forecasters in your piece, including the Future Laboratory. Now, can you just tell me a bit more about this?
Yeah, so since the onset of the pandemic, I've been really interested in how various companies, including consultancies like Future Laboratory, are planning for the future and are thinking about the future. And there's a couple of things that I noticed. So the first is that everybody missed the pandemic, which in part we can expect because these are, you know, these black swan kinds of events. You can't expect anyone to know the precise timing, but we have known that the world is overdue for an event like this, right? Just like we know that recessions are coming. So in that sense, I've been interested sort of unpack this bias in forecasting about telling clients sort of and looking at like the bright side of various developments, which is great until you run into a real disruption like the pandemic.
I was thinking about this. If you think about, and putting my general blushes aside at this point, I was thinking about, you know, 9/11, for example, where, you know, the CIA, national security failed to call something, which again, a lot of scientists were talking about. And also 2008, you know, just you imagine how every economist managed to miss what was happening on the kind of global financial markets. So it's kind of something that seems to be endemic to all kinds of forecasting. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, you know, I think there's two things. One, as I said before, there are always going to be these events that you can never fully know their timing of, right? These black swan events that sort of throw everything for a loop. And as forecasters, you know, the job is not to get everything right 100% of the time. It's to plan for multiple eventualities. But I do think that there's this bias towards optimism. There's this positive asymmetry, this idea that we want to make the best of things. We want to sort of sell ideas that people feel like they have solutions, that they can do things, right? And when you're talking about these sort of, particularly these really disruptive, potentially negative things like a pandemic, like a recession, like a terrorist event, people don't want to hear that, right? That doesn't sort of get people in the mood to feel like the future is one that is going to be bright and optimistic.
Right. So I guess it's a case of it's not being good for, not really good for the forecaster's business and potentially something that I guess a client may not necessarily want to hear about. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about, we did in 2008, we looked at what we call the new sobriety, which is really about how people were, as a consequence of the nervousness in the market, beginning to pull back, beginning to ask questions, and beginning to challenge. And then we did a kind of a follow-up forecast, which we called prohibition culture, which was more about people being judgmental and really wagging and pointing fingers at people who are being excessive. And I kind of felt that in some ways, maybe as forecasters, we were hitting on the global financial crisis and its impact, but not calling it that. We almost wanted to name it something different to your point, make it, I suppose, a bit more saleable to the client and to the brands that we were working with.
Well, we always want to feel like there's a way forward, right? That is a natural human tendency. We want to feel like when faced with adversity or challenges, we can sort of make the best of it. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. And I do think forecasters get a lot of things right and they get the mood right. It's just trying to figure out how to make forecasts a little more resilient to these potential external shocks that we tend not to look for.
I think I'd like to come back to that, but one thing that really struck me about your Medium piece, okay, you looked at, you were talking about the future, and I think you've tackled this in your book as well, and you said that, you know, in some way we've commoditized the future, we've made it into both a marketable and saleable commodity. Can you just talk to me a bit more about your thoughts behind that statement?
Yeah, so the way that I see it and what I talk about in my book is that what companies like Future Laboratory and your peers peddle is a sense of certainty in the face of uncertainty, right? So we know businesses know the world is changing. We know that a narrow focus on the bottom line makes them vulnerable to specific and unexpected changes, right? And we know that in business in general, we're making bets on the future all the time through investment, et cetera, right? So this is why I think of future forecasts in the future as kind of like stories that are these sort of raw materials that can then become sort of packaged and marketed to companies that help them to plan, right? So it's a way of sort of turning the future into a product that can be used strategically.
So I guess, okay, we in some ways have productized it. We've made it saleable. We're probably making it a bit more optimistic, as you say, for the reason that it needs to be more appealing to people. But I guess one of the things that a lot of forecasters, you know, watching and listening will be asking is, that being the case, how do you make the forecast more robust and accurate on one side, and perhaps more honest and not truthful, but more palatable, given the fact that they may be an unpalatable forecast in the first place?
Yeah, so one answer to that question is these ideas of flexibility and resilience. You know, you hear these ideas coming up so much during this pandemic. And I really think that, you know, resilience also means planning for a rainy day. And it means acknowledging that the future is going to have rainy days. And just for an example, you know, you think about what's happening to supply chains right now. And you think about how all of these just-in-time supply chains really are very vulnerable to external shocks like the one we're experiencing under COVID, right? So having a little bit more, you know, a little bit more insurance, maybe not going and cutting exactly to the bone with these efficiencies, actually is, it's a practical strategy, and it's positive. It's sort of a way of flipping what could potentially be a really damaging thing into something that is useful for businesses.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, do you think in some ways, you know, if you think about the word sustainable, I remember when we set out in 2001, which is where we pretty much set up the business, we were talking about sustainability and to some extent discussing purpose. But a lot of brands at the time were not interested and weren't really caring. And also given what was happening with you know, the attack on the Twin Towers, people really didn't want to talk about sustainability. They wanted to talk about getting back hard into the market. Mm. So I guess the other thing that forecasters potentially have a problem with is not just the honesty of the language, but also the realities of trying to sell or market a business where, while you know sustainability is a big core concern and you don't see the client looking for it, you kind of go, well, do I need to tell them? Because at the moment they're not buying it. And I think the last 5 years has probably seen a lot of forecasters push against that and probably been a bit more honest about where they see the market going. I mean, do you think that's the case, or is that just me imagining a better future for my business?
Well, you said two things. And first, I do think it's hard to give, you know, on the one hand, you want to give clients hard truths, but on the other hand, you don't want to give them alienating truths, right? And you don't, there's no use in giving them things that they're not going to listen to, right? But I do think that you're correct in the sense that I've seen a lot more forecasters taking a stand on particular issues that they think are incontrovertible. You know, you've seen this particularly around LGBTQ rights, right? That this is just something that you have to think about. You don't have a choice not to embrace this anymore. And so whether that's going to alienate a company or not is sort of not the issue, right? And I think a lot of companies have come along, and they've come a really long way on that particular issue. And they're starting to come that way on environmentalism. And we're seeing them sort of at an earlier point on that with other kinds of diversity, particularly like racial diversity.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that always made me curious, because when you're, you know, doing, I guess when you're putting together as a new eye, putting together forecasts, you're trying to make them as objective as you can, but you're also trying to make them, I guess, as holistic. And I remember, you know, I can't drive, but I was chatting to people at BMW. You know, I don't eat meat. And I was chatting to a company who really were, you know, focused on selling more meat. You know, I'm a gay person talking about family, or I'm dyslexic talking about, you know, literacy and working with publishers. And I suppose in some ways, part of me sees the benefit of that. But the other part of me sees that in some ways, for them to know it, sometimes it's not relevant, and sometimes it's a quiet relevance that sits behind my thinking with the hope that it maybe informs my thinking a bit more holistically and maybe it makes me a bit more open. But do you think it's important that forecasters declare their allegiances up front, so to speak, when they're talking to a client? In the case of, you know, the BMW, and I can't actually drive nor have any interest in driving a car.
Well, I think we all have knowledge about things which are not our direct experience, and we can't discount that, right? And I think of our direct experience as sometimes it's directly applicable, and sometimes, like you say, it's an echo or an accent or it's a perspective that helps a company, even if that's not their direct market, it helps them to know that people like you are in the world, right? So if you're a company that's trying to sell more meat, you have to know about veganism, right? That is absolutely disrupting your market. Right? Just like if you're a company that's catering to family, you have to think about all of the non-traditional forms of family that are out there. It's almost wrong to call them non-traditional because I feel like they're starting to take over from the traditional family, right?
This is something that I thought there was a great quote. I'm just going to overcome my dyslexia and read the quote out here. The future, you say that you're regarding how businesses and corporations generally see the future. You say they see the future as a critical territory of strategy and competition that they actively shape to their advantage and probably do so without involving ordinary people or ordinary voices. Now, I thought that was quite a powerful statement because you were so right in that people create the future. That's what we do, what businesses do. But here you're really flagging up the fact that a lot of the time it's not just an ideal, it excludes the real and the realities of ordinary people and ordinary lives in that forecast. Can you just tell me a little more about what made you think about that in the first place?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in how we talk about the future almost like it's the weather, right? Like it's a hurricane coming across an ocean and it's just going to come and we have to be ready for it. And that's not true at all. The future is made up by you and me and everyone. Now, those complicated forces means that no one of us, no one company, no one person has the ability most of the time to impact the future, unless you're someone like Donald Trump or Boris Johnson, maybe you can have an outsized impact, right? But that still doesn't take away from the fact that we're the ones who make it, right? And so I think that in order, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of ordinary people who feel that. They feel like the future is happening to them. And I think we need to do more to empower them to feel like they're agents and active sort of participants in the future. And that's what I mean in thinking about the ordinary voices, not just the people who are in the C-suite or, you know, who are in the political positions to really be very influential, but the rest of us who have to adopt and take up those futures that are happening.
I guess it's been really interesting. We looked at probably about 2010, the rise of, you know, populism, as we call it now. We didn't define it as such then. We called them the just nots, you know, people who just were not able to buy a house, just not able to buy a car, felt marginally excluded by the, you know, the urban elites, et cetera, et cetera. And it really, I suppose, that sense that we should allow the ordinary to be part of the forecast. And then somebody asked me the question, well, if you think about populism, how it's pushed back against quite a lot of the freedoms that people had fought for, and a lot of those freedoms were alien at the time, and a lot of them seem to be really not the kind of thing that ordinary people would vote for, you know, gay rights, equality, the notion of you know, women having an equal position in the workplace, etc. And although I can go, oh my gosh, maybe they're right as well. Maybe the forecast has to be ideal and not just allow for ordinary people. Or is that me being idealistic and not really paying attention to the world around me?
I think you can sort of thread the needle on this one, right? So by which I mean, on the one hand, you have to be aware of the fact that there are perspectives and ideas that are not your own, right? I live in the coastal United States, right? Part of the coastal elite, right? But I'm from but I'm from the middle of the country, and I have a lot of friends who are in the southern parts of the country. That's where my family is from, right? I have to realize that my reality and their reality are different, and that that there are perspectives that they can bring to the table that will drive the future that I will live, just like the things that I bring to the table help to drive the things that they will live. But going back to something we were saying before, companies like Future Laboratory and other forecasters, you have a particular staff, you have a particular perspective, you have particular interests and politics, whether you name them such or not. So, you know, if you were to be approached by a client that was asking you to take up something that was really anti-LGBT rights or extremely anti-environmental, you probably wouldn't take that work on. So it's an awareness, but not a, you know, but also knowing where you stand.
Right. And I think this is probably the, you know, you've hit on the kind of light breaking through there, in that I think a lot of the time, perhaps we are passively aware of those things. We assume that knowledge that we have sits on the other side as well. And therefore, as a consequence, you know, with the issue of you know, populism, for example, you know, what's happening in Europe, where the far right are slightly, you know, pushing up again, they're rowing back on what seem to be fairly straightforward citizen rights, that it's where perhaps if we haven't listened to, and I think this is maybe where you're coming from, we haven't really listened to the worries or the stresses of people every day. And as a consequence, the forecasts we're creating are so removed from the reality of how people would like the world to be, that naturally they're fighting against it, but also they're potentially seeing it as this is the only way they can have their voice heard, is by to be being extreme and pushing back and believing that, not that I think other people are wrong. I'm not sure if that's the case at all. I think they probably just believe that they are not being listened to, and therefore their voice is being neutered. So that was the kind of thing I was getting from the point you were making in the piece. And there was also, I guess, the question then, how, if that's the case, how can we make our forecasting and our businesses, you know, much more engaging and proactive and allowing those multiple voices to come in?
Well, you know, it's a little bit cliche to say this, but like diversity and inclusion, they really matter, and they matter not just cosmetically, right? It matters because we live in cities and nations and worlds that are filled with all different kinds of people. And it's really important that we reflect that in the composition of our offices and our workplaces, but also in the compositions of the reports and the forecasts, you know? And it's also, you know, I think about this a lot in terms of class identity in particular, right? And one of the things I noticed in my book is that in forecasting companies and futures companies, you often have people who, even if they're racially diverse, even if you have all kinds of gender diversity and all kinds of diversity around sexual orientation, what have you, you often have people who went to a small number of schools, who come from big cities, who have either never lived in sort of rural parts of the country, or who actively avoided them and moved to the city because of that, right? So you often get a diversity that doesn't reflect a lot of ideological diversity. So I think it's accounting for that. And, you know, again, not embracing it so that you end up making populist futures, but just knowing that that is there, and thinking about how those things kind of shape the things that you're working on.
I guess you're right, because I, you know, we always think the that kind of network approach, and like the super forecasting, like the Philip Tetlocks, where you create that network of difference of people who are from hugely divergent backgrounds, and you ask them the question, and you get an accrued answer that potentially offers you a more nuanced but perhaps more useful view of the future. But then, as somebody said, you know, you do that in the elite centers, you do it in you know, the articulate kind of communities. And then somebody once said, actually, you also do it with, you know, people who speak your language, because, you know, you go and interview somebody in China, and you're trying to find somebody who speaks English. You're not trying to find somebody who speaks the local language or the dialect. And I think maybe it is beholden to us to really, I suppose, actively examine the way we tackle those kind of, I guess, selective processes from the very root, rather than, I think at the moment, we, for example, in our business, we do it based on a straightforward criteria. You know, you answer the questions, you're in as a forecaster, you pass through as what I would call an innovator or an early adopter. And in my head, I'm already pre-marking them as people who live on the edge, you know, in vibrant communities, in professions that are slightly anomalous to kind of standard processes. But maybe we need to look at those early majority and late majority people in the same way. Is that kind of what you're saying? Or
yeah, I was actually just thinking about adoption curves and how much the whole idea of forecasting is based on the notion that there are certain consumers and places that are ahead of others, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are people like Irma Zandel is one who comes to mind, who are always looking kind of at the middle, saying that, you know, that's where most people are, that's where most people are headed. But there's also not a need to necessarily think of the future in such a linear way, right? Because people are always going to be at different perspectives. Yeah. There are different ideas about the future and how we find the future in different parts of the world, right? One of the things I talked about in my book is it's been hard for a lot of forecasters to get a foothold in Asia. And that's not just because of the questions you bring up around language. It's also because they don't have the same cultural context in terms of thinking about the future and finding it useful to have those conversations, right? So the conversations themselves feel alien to people sometimes.
That's again, you're looking at it from the other perspective, which again is one of the things that I guess forecasting should teach us. That it's always about not just alternative and other and different perspectives, but it also perhaps should alert us to the monocultural nature of some of the forecasts that we produce. And really, I was thinking, given what's happening with, you know, Me Too, given what's happening with, you know, Black Lives Matter in the lesbian, gay community, that suddenly people are aware that there are multiple perspectives. And my question is, do you think that is being included in, you know, when you're looking at, think about the book, the numbers of people you spoke to, how you survey the forecasting scene generally. Do you think people are embracing those changes, asking questions, or is it just seen to be another pillar box they tick, but that really not doing anything about it?
I think that they want to, right? And wanting to is part of, you know, that's the first step. That's very different than not wanting to. So I think there's a real sympathy and a real desire to be inclusive, to embrace diversity, to be sensitive to difference, right? But when I looked, you know, I interviewed 75 futurists and forecasters for my book. Wow.
That's
and,
more than I did, I have to say. Yeah. You were hard at work. You were working for
working overtime. Yeah, oh, those days are over. That's one of the gifts of the pandemic, right, is that I'm not working until 10 p.m. every night. But I saw a lot of women, but I saw a lot of white people, and especially the higher you go up in these firms, right? And I saw a lot of people between a particular age group, you know, from about 30 to say 55 was generally the perspective. And like I said, people coming from particular universities who fled the centers in the rural parts of countries to live on the coasts in these cosmopolitan cities. And so it's not to say that what I think we can, like we were talking about with the BMW example, or, you know, you can know things about other ways of being without having that direct experience yourself. That's absolutely true. But there's also certain blind spots and certain limits that come with that. And you do get something different when you have someone who's lived a different life from you. And I do think that forecasters could do more work around that.
I guess, you know, I guess in some ways with, you know, if you think about scenario planning as a part of forecasting, or, you know, using your three horizon forecasts, or even the notion of backcasting, you know, where you take a point in the future and you work back. A lot of them have to and must involve imagination. And that, I guess, the kind of scenario planning you see or think about in films, books, theater, you know, the arts generally. And I was kind of thinking, in some ways, while we're trying to create facts for the future, which is what the client is thinking about, in some ways, a lot of those things are built on fictions. And probably a lot of forecasting, because I think to your point about, you know, having empathy, multiple perspectives, understanding other backstories, that really that's what writers think about, and artists and people who are creators, you know, they will do that automatically. So maybe forecasters have a lot to learn from the kind of the arts and fiction rather than fact. I mean, I think like science fiction probably contains a great forecast, but it's all about speculation rather than about fact. Do you think we should spend more time looking at what I'm going to call the adjective of living rather than the facts of living?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So one of the things that I looked at in my book is Afrofuturism. And Afrofuturism, you know, when I was looking for sort of racial diversity among forecasting companies, like I said, I didn't find a lot of it, especially at the middle to the top. And I didn't find any in the US, I didn't find any like Black futurist organizations. Oh, but what I did find were people who were thinking about the future outside of the traditional kind of consultancy model. I found artists, I found conferences, I found there's an amazing lawyer in Philadelphia who's trained as a futurist but works as an attorney on housing futures, right? And so it's a requirement to sort of just look elsewhere, right? And not get stuck in your, you know, I think futurists get stuck in their ruts too. You have your usual sources, you have your usual suspects, you have, like you said, you go to the hip neighborhoods and you look for the people who speak English and who are dressed a certain way, right? And that all is, you know, you get really great stuff there, but there's a lot of things that you miss through those channels as well.
I'm sort of hiding my face here because I just think, you know, a lot of this resonates. And I think it's interesting at the moment. We've started, I think, you know, because of what's happening globally, we're saying, okay, we need not just, you know, diversity and inclusion and equality as a core value in a business, which I always thought was there, because you just think, you know, you're Irish, you're gay, you're vegan, you come from a small town, you must know. And actually you realize, unless you're proactively thinking about this, it just sets by the wayside. So one of the things we're saying, let's now make that a way for us to do business internally as with each other. And then you can talk to clients about it. Because one of the things that struck me in your piece, you said, you know, futurism, and this is what I thought, I was going, wow, okay, you've sort of summed it up fairly succinctly here. That takes me about 10 hours. Being Irish, I talk forever. 10 hours to say, and this is what you said, you know, futurism may not provide a flawless roadmap of the future, but it is something that sharpens focus on likely outcomes, you know, forces us to think ahead and demand that we plan for multitude and multiple possibilities. Now, I thought that was really interesting because a lot of forecasters want you to have one answer and clients really are happy with one answer, but everybody knows it is about the multiples, and that multiple probably therefore means everybody has to participate in building that potential future. Is that really what you think futurism is about, as opposed to the single, you know, that's the forecast, here's my answer, give me my fee?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's easier. Everybody wants that magic bullet, right? They want that thing. And it's difficult to give people options. You know, I'm a professor. I love giving my students options. And often they're like, just tell me what to do, right? So I think we can all sort of fall into that a little bit. But this goes back to what we were saying earlier about resilience, about flexibility, and about understanding that the future can come in many different forms. It comes in many different forms at the same time for different people, right? We're seeing this now during the pandemic, where some of us are working away at home, you know, with our computers and doing just fine, and even have more money than maybe we did because we're not going to restaurants and whatnot. And other people have been laid off. Things are happening simultaneously. Right, so we need to sort of account for the diversity and the multiplicity that can come.
You see, again, because I've written here, and that was one of my questions, and it really, in some ways, it was just like a summary of that, you know, the notion that there's the possible, probable, plausible, and as you said up front, the notion of the unpalatable future, and that really these are the things we need to consider if we are to, I guess, engage positively and honestly with tomorrow. I mean, is that kind of, you know, do you think companies will want to hear that? Or do you think we need just to tell them and say, that's the way it is, you've got to like it or lump it?
I think it's a bit of both, right? It's like, you don't give somebody a, what's the saying? Like, you know, you have to give a spoonful of sugar with the medicine, right. So to speak, right?
My favorite musical, you're already onto Mary Poppins, and Mary Poppins in France, which, by the way,
that's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here for. I like to say, that's why they pay me the medium bucks, right? but yeah, you know, we really do. It's just so absolutely necessary to remember that it's us who's in the driver's seat, right? And the world is big and complex, and we cannot control for every contingency. We can't cover every outcome, but we can think about taking the influence of our futures really seriously, taking our, you know, taking that voice to clients and saying, like, you know, we need to account for the idea that there might be some difficulties ahead, but if we think about it, when they arrive, we will be ready. And that's the lesson that I hope people take from this particular moment. And I think with all of the disruption of the pandemic, I hope that companies are listening to that.
Yeah, to do it. So we're almost out of time. And I just wanted to do this classic thing. There's always this moment in the session where we say, you know, can you make a prediction that may or may not, well, actually, maybe a prediction that could come back to haunt you in a future session? What do you think your prediction for tomorrow will be?
So make a possible prediction. Right. So I think, you know, blockchain fever has sort of dissipated a little bit, but one of the things I think is a possibility with blockchain is using it to account for social interaction. And I think that this has some real possible utopian and also some potentially dystopian undersides to it. So I think about that all the time, like blockchain accounting for conversations between you and I, for hugs, for visits to nursing homes, those kinds of things.
I think I'm going to agree with you on this one, because I was thinking the other day, you know, we used to have the Harvard verification system that really checked facts. And increasingly in a world of kind of fake news and that, I really want a system that just runs in the background and pulls out some clear facts. So I'm going to give you that as a forecast I'm going to go with. I'm going to give you a forecast here, which, well, let's think about it. Okay, this is a 1966 issue of Time magazine, which claimed that, here we go, remote shopping, while entirely feasible, will flop. Because, here we go again, women will like to get out of the house, they like to handle the merchandise, and they like to be able to change their minds. I mean, can you imagine? You know, how wrong is that on every level?
Absolutely. And, you know, but I will say that, you know, at this point, I do like getting out of the house. So I'd be happy to have an excuse to go and
say, I do like feeling the merchandise. And I also like, you know, probably just that idea of browsing. So maybe they weren't so wrong about it. But I just wanted to thank you for joining us again, for agreeing to take part in Back to the Future. Almost got that wrong. And just to remind people, the original idea we were chatting about came from your column, which is published on Medium. Your book also looks at the notion of on trends, you know, the business of how forecasting, the business of forecasting the future is now available on Amazon, I think. You're also saying at good bookstores, but we will also be carrying a link at the bottom of this podcast and Zoomcast, so people can find out more about it. So until next time, keep listening, keep learning, and keep watching out for tomorrow. Devon, many thanks.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful.